WHO says it wants to stay out of politics, but politics can't seem to stay away from the WHO.
We regret the decision of the President of the United States to order a halt in funding to the World Health Organization.
The International Monetary Fund is predicting a quick global economic recovery next year.
Possibly not to the level of 2019, but quite significantly.
And New York's Museum of Modern Art is closed. There's always MoMA online, though. Meet your remote tour guide, a museum security guard.
A lot of these guards are artists themselves, and that's a big reason why they work here. They want to be surrounded by these pieces of art.
Beauty during a pandemic. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. As you've heard, President Trump says he's withholding funding to the World Health Organization. The president wants to review the role of the WHO in, quote, severely mismanaging and covering up the spread of the coronavirus, end quote. That was last night. Today, the head of the WHO responded.
When we're divided, the virus exploits the cracks between us.
Tedros Ghebreyesus said the United States has been a generous friend to the WHO and hopes the relationship will continue.
We regret the decision of the President of the United States to order a halt in funding to the World Health Organization.
The U.S. funds about 15% of the organization's annual budget. Today, countries across the globe are condemning President Trump. Sibeth Ndjaye is a spokeswoman for the French government. She called Trump's announcement a blow to multilateralism.
À chaque fois qu'il y a une encoche dans le multilatéralisme que cette
encoche Ndjaye said, we obviously hope very much that there is a rapid return to normal so the WHO can focus on the work in this unprecedented pandemic. David Heyman is a former assistant director general at the WHO, where he headed up the global response to SARS. He's now a leading infectious disease expert at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. David Heyman, how big of a deal is it that President Trump is suspending funding for the WHO, putting it on pause for the foreseeable future?
Well, you know, WHO has two budgets into which the U.S. contributes. One is the regular assessed contributions that all member countries pay based on a formula that was developed after World War II. And the other is extra budgetary resources that are provided for specific programs. It's not clear what budget would be in jeopardy, but should this be the extra budgetary programs, for example, then programs which the U.S. supports solidly, such as polio eradication, would be at great risk.
Can other member states or other entities make up for this loss?
Well, so far they've attempted to open up this formula, and no country has been willing to have it opened up and contribute more than they are now. But that's the regular WHO budget. The extra budget is funded by many, many groups, including the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, including the United States, and many G7 and G20 countries. So the extra budget of WHO is quite well funded by the U.S. and other countries.
I mean, Trump and his advisors have long been critical of the inefficiencies at the UN and its agencies. Does that criticism extend to the WHO?
I think that criticism extends to all UN agencies, as far as I understand it. But I'm not concerned so much about that as about the technical capacities, which at WHO remain high. WHO actually has some of the best public health experts in the world working with them.
President Trump is critical of the WHO and its relationship with China. Is that MAGA rhetoric, or is there a legitimate concern about that relationship?
You know, I can't speak about the politics going on globally. That's not my field. My field is a technical field. And all I can say, again, is that the technical expertise in WHO and in its many advisory bodies is of top quality in producing top quality recommendations that go to countries to help them deal with this pandemic. You know, within a period of about a month and a half, much was already known about this outbreak, enough that people could begin to really understand how they could deal with this best based on their national risk assessments and WHO's guidance and information. So the progress that's been made has been quite impressive, as it was during the SARS outbreak when clinical, epidemiological, and virological experts worked together to figure out what was going on.
You're implying that the U.S. obviously was privy to that data in that month and a half as well.
The U.S. was contributing to that data and was privy to that data, yes.
You were at the WHO for years, David Heyman. Was there a time when the U.S. and the WHO had a better relationship? Has it changed over time?
I think the relationships change over time with the WHO and with every government that's involved with WHO. Governments have specific red lines that they put down. And when those red lines begin to be crossed by the World Health Assembly, which is all the ministers of health from around the world, then there become tensions. But those tensions are usually worked out. And I've never seen any real tensions that could not be overcome, even during the Cold War. When the U.S. and Russia were at odds, the USSR at that point, people were working together in smallpox eradication and actually saw a great success. I myself was 2 years in smallpox eradication in India with the CDC at various times during that period of time. And I worked side by side with Russian technical people, and we all contributed to the great success that that program was.
Finally, what do you think this means for the U.S. and its response to the coronavirus without this connection to the WHO right now? Does it isolate the U.S. in any way from what might be a coordinated global response?
WHO's advice is available to all countries in all territories in all areas, including to places like Taiwan. So there's no real difficulty that I can see in the U.S. accessing information from WHO. And also, I'm sure that the U.S. will continue to contribute information and assessments to WHO. There's great collaboration right now in clinical trials area with the NIH, with CDC and various other aspects. And that has been a traditional collaboration with WHO, and I would anticipate that that will continue.
David Heymann is a former assistant director general at the WHO, where he headed up the global response to SARS. He's now a leading infectious disease expert at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For another take on this, we turn to someone who knows a lot about dealing with international organizations, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. She has a new book out called Hell and Other Destinations, a 21st century memoir. I asked Albright what she made of the president's decision to suspend WHO funding.
I think it is the most counterproductive move he possibly could have made. Clearly, there were problems and problems the Chinese are going to have to answer for at some point, but having been at the UN, I can tell you there's no way to have your views taken seriously or call for reform if you're not being supportive. And it's definitely taking yourself out of a situation instead of really trying to deal with the problem. The UN is 75 years old. They do need some help in fixing these organizations, but we can't do it from the outside.
What sort of reform do you think the WHO needs?
The WHO did provide warnings, but I think that there are obviously issues in every organization about how they function internally, the bureaucratic aspects, their relationships, but we have to be at the table and we have to contribute and support it and not create additional problems by all of a sudden going around its back.
I don't want to do an audit of the WHO in the middle of a pandemic, but specifically, where do you think the reform should happen?
The United Nations, many of the organizations, are actually very dependent on getting intelligence from the outside. And it's probably a good idea to try to sort out when and how they get their information. But it's unfair just to accuse them of having screwed everything up and blaming them for something that we need to take some responsibility for. And the Chinese obviously do.
So as far as Trump's announcement regarding funding for the WHO, do you see it as theater and an effort to scapegoat? And what message does it send to the rest of the world?
I think that it sends a very difficult message that the United States doesn't have to cooperate with international organizations, that the President of the United States can go to the General Assembly session and talk only about how important our country is and sovereignty without understanding that in the 21st century, there are issues that can only be handled by more than one country. And obviously, disease knows no borders. Globalization is not a four-letter word. It is the interconnectedness of the world in the 21st century. He has not explained, frankly, what he is going to do, where he's going to put money. Is he going to go through some other organization? And just kind of standing up and saying, I'm canceling or I'm not going to contribute without explaining what is going to happen, I think is a grandstand.
Multilateral diplomacy is all but dead. So what comes next on the world stage in terms of power relations?
Americans don't like the word multilateralism. It has too many syllables and it ends in an ism, but it's just about partnerships and a recognition that you need partners in solving problems. And trade and aid are obviously tools. But in order for us to have a good trade policy, which I believe we need to do, there need to be people that are healthy enough to buy our things. I'm very worried about what I'm reading that's happening in the developing world, where the virus is also hitting, that don't have anywhere near health situation that they can distance from each other. And who do we expect to buy all the things that we're exporting? How are we going to deal with supply chains? So there's an awful lot that's interconnected that requires some kind of an active cooperation. Given what's going on in the 21st century, we are interdependent. There's just no question.
Secretary Albright, it's no secret you're known for wearing brooches that convey historical moments that you're living through. Do you have a brooch for this moment?
I do, actually. It's a V. And I'll tell you where it comes from. I do also write about the fact that I was just a child, but we spent World War II in London during the Blitz. And my father was with the Czechoslovak government in exile, and he spoke over BBC to Czechoslovakia. And every BBC broadcast would begin with a kettle drum and the notes from the Beethoven's Fifth, da-da-da-dum, which is basically Morse code for victory. And so I have a V-pin. We need a victory over the virus.
Onwards. Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright's latest book is called Hell and Other Destinations, a 21st Century Memoir. Secretary, very good to speak with you again. Thank you.
Very nice to talk to you. Thank you.
As politicians grapple over funding and how best to tackle the pandemic, on the ground, the virus is taking a human toll. It's killed more than 130,000 people. With numbers at large, remember that each of those numbers represents a human life, a mom or a dad, sister or brother, maybe an aunt or a boyfriend or a grandfather. One of those deaths was an 81-year-old woman named Rose Mitchell. She went by Billy and died earlier this month in a London nursing home. Shortly after her death, her sister Dorothy Duffy wrote a poem to her. Here's an excerpt.
My sister is not a statistic. Tomorrow, when the deathometer of COVID is announced in sonorous tones, my sister will be among those numbers, among the throwaway lines, among the platitudes and lowered eyes, an older person with underlying health conditions, a pitiful way to lay rest the bare bones of a life. My sister is not a statistic. Her underlying conditions were love, kindness, belief in the essential goodness of mankind, uproarious laughter, forgiveness, compassion, a storyteller, a force of nature, and so much more. My sister is not a statistic. She died without the soft touch of a loved one's hand, without the muted murmur of familiar family voices gathered round her bed. My sister is not a statistic.
Dorothy Duffy there remembering her sister Rose Mitchell, who died this month from COVID-19. The poem ends by saying that someday we'll all smile and laugh again. An encouraging thought, a reminder that this pandemic is, above all, about people. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. 1 year ago today, tragedy in Paris. A fire broke out on the roof of the Notre Dame Cathedral. France quickly pledged to rebuild the church. The restoration will certainly take years because Notre Dame isn't just any building. It's a place with a unique sound. Emma Jacobs reports on what it will take for that to be restored.
Vincent Dubois is one of the three organists of Notre Dame. He was outside Paris when he learned that the cathedral had caught fire.
It's like one of the closest members of your family, your husband, your partner, or your brother or sister, was burning beside you, and there was nothing you could do.
It wasn't until 6 a.m., the morning after the fire, that he got a text message. It said the organ had survived.
We got this news, and that was reassuring, even miraculous.
Dubois describes the acoustics of Notre Dame as extraordinary, unlike any other cathedral he's heard.
The resonance is unlike anywhere else. It's both precise while at the same time lasting in the way the sound reverberates.
Brian Katz studies sound. He's an acoustician by trade. And he could hear the difference when he was able to enter Notre Dame last July. He described the way sunlight streamed through the now open roof.
What was the most stark at that time that I remember visually was the number of things that weren't burned and weren't damaged, kind of side by side. Having a big piece of burnt roof sitting next to a perfectly fine altar or statuette that was undamaged.
Though the cathedral sounded, he says, completely different than before the fire.
The fact that there's these holes in the roof, the reverberation time has dropped significantly. So you don't feel like you're walking into a cathedral acoustically anymore.
But Katz has an acoustic map of Notre Dame, created by his research lab at the Sorbonne University in Paris. He later learned that they're the only set of measurements of the cathedral's acoustics before the fire.
The measurements that we did in 2013 were after the concert that we recorded. So it was, I think, between 10 o'clock and midnight, or maybe 1 o'clock in the morning. There were about 10 of us moving microphones around.
Playing sounds in one spot and recording when they reach other spots around the cathedral.
The sound that I tend to typically use is called a chirp.
A chirp is a tone that swoops from very low frequencies to very high. This is one from the recordings made in Notre Dame.
We make these measurements in a lot of different combinations of where the sound could be coming from and where the sound can be listened to, which then we use to calibrate the acoustic model that we create afterwards.
These recordings, this acoustic model of the cathedral, were an experiment. Katz's team used them to make a video simulation that lets you fly around Notre Dame on a magic carpet and hear the music of a concert transformed.
It was not planned to be as important as it was, as it has turned out to be.
They realized after the fire last April that these measurements could help in Notre Dame's reconstruction.
Acoustics is an effect of the choices of all the other disciplines. So the structural engineers and the stonemasons and the architectural finishes, all those choices of details are what creates the acoustics of a space.
All cathedrals have lots of big, flat, reflective surfaces. And even small modifications can change the resonance of the space.
In some places, changing the painting or the cleaning the stone, that's been known to have happened.
And you can imagine rebuilding Notre Dame will involve many, many changes. But with the measurements and the type of software used to design concert halls, Katz can advise on how to make all these choices add up to something that sounds like the Notre Dame of before the fire.
The earlier the acoustics is thought of and considered, then the more integrated it can be in the design. And important decisions can be made at the right time as opposed to later in the project when it's more difficult to change things.
Katz's team planned to return to Notre Dame this spring to take new measurements of what it sounds like now. The trip got postponed when Paris shut down because of the coronavirus. But the French government has pledged to rebuild the cathedral. Organist Vincent Dubois says his instrument can be restored and retuned. Still, even after the best restoration effort, he thinks, it will take a few years for Notre Dame to sound like it once did.
It's also the dust of the space, simply put. It's a place in which there is so much foot traffic. There are many candles to be burned, so lots of soot, which ends up all over everything.
The only thing that can restore that, Dubois thinks, is time. A short time, really, in the life of the centuries-old cathedral. For the world, I'm Emma Jacobs.
One thing to come out of the Notre Dame fire are bee colonies. The honey bees living on top of the French National Monument survive. Not only that, they are thriving. Sybille Moulin looks after the bees through her company, Biopic. Sybille, how are the bees of Notre Dame doing?
Very well. It's spring and it's wonderful for them.
So how did they manage to survive? Because wasn't there a lot of toxic fumes coming from the fire?
I think the toxic fume go toward the sky and not the heights. And it's always a bit windy in Paris. So the wind blow it away before all the smoke and the bad things goes down again.
So when we say these honeybees from Notre Dame are now flourishing, what does it actually mean? Are they healthier than ever? Are they producing honey?
Oh, yes, they are producing honey. They produced honey last year, and they use that honey to survive during the winter. I took some because, you know, being a beekeeper, I'm a big parasite. So I make sure I leave some for them. It's now that they reproduce themselves. So the old queen leave the colony with maybe 30,000 bees in a big swarm in the sky. It's very noisy. It's very nice. I love it when I see that. But it's scary for people. They are rather scared about the bees doing that. So that's why we go and take on the bees first. We try to remove the pressure inside the hive.
Mm. With the ongoing lockdown restrictions in France, how hard has it been to visit the hives?
Not so much for Notre Dame, because it was already very complicated with the lead contamination. So you have to go through all the lead things. You have to get rid of all your clothes, put disposable clothes, then check the hives, then come back, then get rid of the disposable clothes, have a huge shower during 15 minutes and get back to your clothes. So it was already very complicated to see them.
So Notre Dame's bells will be ringing tonight. Are you excited for that?
Yes. Yes, definitely. Because you know the name of that bell in French is bourdon, which means bumblebee.
Really?
Yeah. So for me, it's special because I remember my grandmother saying she lives in Versailles. She has known that Paris was liberated in 1944 because she heard that bell ringing. So I've never heard that ringing before. And so tonight I'm eager to listen to that. I hope I will hear it from where I am in the suburb. I don't know if it will reach me.
Still, that's a very special connection for you.
Yeah. Family and history and everything and biological also with the bumblebee. It's wonderful.
Sybille Moulin is a beekeeper with Biopic. She's been speaking with us about the honeybees that survived and thrived 1 year after the Notre Dame fire. Sybille Moulin, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
News headlines are next. You're listening to The World. In parts of Southeast Asia, it's New Year's according to an ancient calendar. Normally, that would mean serious street parties.
Once a year, for a week straight, everyone goes out in their bathing suits with buckets of water, and they splash each other.
This year, the Thai government's advice, be boring. Partying is against the law. That's coming up here on The World. There's a global backlash against President Trump's decision to halt American funding for the World Health Organization. That would slash about 10% of the organization's operating budget during the pandemic. Germany and China are denouncing the president's plan. So are all the 55 member states of the African Union. WHO support is critical in many parts of Africa, places like the Democratic Republic of Congo. The DRC is not only dealing with the coronavirus outbreak, but also Ebola. Dr. Michelle Yao is the program manager for Emergency Response for Africa for the WHO and joins us from Brazzaville. Dr. Yao, what do you make of Trump's call to stop U.S. donations to the WHO?
I think we acknowledge the support received from the U.S. so far in many different public health interventions. And based on this support, we had many achievements. The comment that I can make is that it's quite unfortunate that this happened at this moment where we need most of the members around us. We're appealing really for more solidarity and being together for this unprecedented crisis.
I know we're thinking a lot about coronavirus, but I know at the beginning of this week, the DRC was hoping that it could declare itself Ebola-free, and yet two people died from Ebola. That's got to be really disappointing for health workers. What does it mean for the DRC's ability to effectively deal with two epidemics at the same time?
In a fragile health system like the one we have in DRC, it means that the resources will be overstretched. You have to deal with Ebola that is absorbing a lot of resources. If we want to control, it requires a dedicated attention. At the same time, you have another disease that also spread faster than Ebola. So it will mean that the resources have to deal with the two challenges, and there will be more of a stress. So there is a need for different partners to remain on board and around.
When the Ebola outbreak started in the DRC in August of 2018, so nearly 2 years ago, many people didn't believe it was real. In fact, as you know, militias shot and killed health workers over it, colleagues of yours. How are people in the DRC reacting to COVID-19? Are they taking it more seriously?
It's the same in DRC as well as in many countries. You see, this deadly virus has a lot of rumors. So it's like in many communicable diseases, it required a lot of awareness. So I think we learned a lot from Ebola, that we need to share the right information. We need to also engage communities to be on board, to assign them tasks for them to own the response. And is that what we are doing? Learning from Ebola, we are building on what we did, but these rumors are always there.
With your background, Dr. Yao, in emergency responses to epidemics, how does COVID-19 compare? Is it too soon to compare it to other outbreaks you've been through?
The COVID is, I think, from my experience, is one of the things that I've never seen, the way it's affected many countries at the same time. So you find out all the worldwide resources absorbed by this outbreak, and it leaves less for support to the weakest. I'm in charge of emergency operation for WHO Africa, and in my experience, we deal with a few countries. Major outbreak never affect more than 10 countries at once. But this time, we have in our region that we cover 47 countries, we have 45 of them in crisis. So this is what makes it totally different from what we saw in the past.
Dr. Michelle Yao is WHO's Program Manager for Emergency Response for Africa. Dr. Yao, thank you very much and good luck.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. Thank you.
In parts of Southeast Asia, Thailand, Cambodia, and Myanmar to be precise, a new year is dawning. That's according to an ancient calendar system that resets in April, right before the start of the rainy season. New Year celebrations are always a big deal, except this year, as the world's Patrick Nguyen reports from Bangkok.
If you tried to think of a way to spread the coronavirus as fast as possible, just to give health officials a panic attack, you might come up with something like this. Songkran. It's the New Year holiday in Thailand, and street parties are how people celebrate. Once a year, for a week straight, everyone goes out in their bathing suits with buckets of water, and they splash each other. All day, all night, lots of people are wasted, and crowds are so packed that you are often squished against random people. Normally, dumping water on a stranger would get you slapped, but during Songkran, people won't really judge you for that, or for getting all up in their space. It's all part of the fun. Another Songkran tradition, strangers take goopy clay, run up to you, and smear it on your face, just to make you squeal. People look forward to this all year. A lot of working class folks, they only get one full week of vacation, and this is it. So they are primed to party. But suddenly, partying is against the law. Even if you just splash around right in front of your house, as this Thai news anchor explains, you are violating the state of emergency. And you can actually go to jail for a year. That's not all. In most of the country, the sale of alcohol, banned. Even here in Bangkok, one of the most infamous party towns in Asia. This is a city official, Pongsakon Kwanmeung, saying, the situation here in Thailand is getting better every day. We don't want any super spreaders to ruin that. The idea being, drunk people are more likely to make dumb choices and go out and spread infection. And some already seem eager to prove him right. That is a bunch of teenagers over the weekend, drinking booze, shirtless, splashing each other on the side of the road. And they really should not have uploaded that video to Facebook because they got arrested. Now, Songkran is traditionally supposed to be a time for cleansing, symbolic cleansing. That's what all the water is for. These street parties are kind of a perversion of the real Songkran ceremony, which takes place at home. It's a ritual to bless your elders. You bow down before grandma, for example, pour a little water on her hands, and wish her good fortune.
This will result in the warmth of the family and, more importantly, to be with the elders of Thai society.
That is how the Thai Tourism Board describes it. But this year, officials are saying even that is risky because the elderly are extra vulnerable to COVID-19. And their advice is stay away from your elders, stay sober, have a boring Songkran, because this year at least, having too much fun is against the law. For The World, Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok, Thailand.
The International Monetary Fund has a lot on its plate at its spring meeting underway right now. The IMF has nearly $1 trillion in its toolbox that it uses to try to create global financial stability and economic growth. So no surprise this pandemic crisis is keeping the IMF busy.
Never in the history of the IMF we have had so many countries asking for financial support at the same time.
That's the IMF's managing director, Kristalina Georgieva. Georgieva is this week's guest on the podcast, The Economist Asks, brought to us by The Economist magazine. Anne McElvoy is a host. And what are the most pressing issues these countries are facing?
Well, certainly they need to get their healthcare systems up to par or at least functioning in a way that can take COVID out of the system as fast as is possible, given the spread of the virus and what it needs to clamp down on it. And it's also where people live in cities where they find socially distancing very difficult, where they're dependent on daily income. They desperately often need remittances sent by members of their families who've gone abroad to work.
With advanced economies coming to a standstill, remittances are drying up, causing additional hardship in these countries.
We've got to remember, too, that this spring meeting of the IMF, where this is all being discussed through Friday, it's happening remotely. That's going to be quite a feat, isn't it?
It is quite a feat. It's one of the things I asked Ms. Georgieva, what's it like? She said, well, I'm actually dealing with a workforce, some of whom are in their pyjamas. She said, oh, everyone's getting on with it very well. Very interesting whether that will change the terms of trade between the major countries and indeed the other countries who rely on the IMF in the way that meetings are carried out. And we'll see whether this is just this year or whether it's a system that's perhaps kept going forwards. I think actually they'll be looking forwards to seeing each other face to face again.
Yeah, no doubt. Finally, the question everybody wants an answer to right now, how long or when will this recovery actually take place? Did Georgieva give any idea about that?
Well, if you want a bit of a silver lining, the IMF's view is if there is no big recurrence of COVID, the 2021 could be a relatively good year in the global economy. The only problem is that the year that went before it, the one we're in, looks like a basket case in economic and financial terms. So I think we'd be looking at a 5 to 10 year recovery period, and that's even for the countries who get the recipe right. For the rest, it's going to be a very long tail indeed.
Especially in the fourth quarter of 2020, there could be a start of a rebound, provided that the virus spread is under control. In that case, 2021 would be a year in which the economy will recover, possibly not to the level of 2019, but quite significantly.
Well, there's a bit of optimism.
It's as much as you get from the boss of the IMF. It's interesting that she does think there will be a bounce back as soon as there is a sign that COVID is winging its way out of our lives. But it is going to take time, it's going to take patience, and it's going to take international cooperation.
Anne McElvoy, host of the podcast The Economist Asks. Thanks very much for being with us again.
Always great to be with you, Marco.
Countries like Bangladesh, where the average adult gets by on just a couple $1,000s a year, they rely heavily on the IMF for support. Bangladesh has about 1,200 reported cases of COVID-19, none so far in the overcrowded refugee camps filled with Rohingya Muslims, a heavily persecuted minority group. The Bangladeshi government has put the camps under lockdown anyway. As the world's Rupa Shenoy reports, stopping a disease outbreak in the camps will depend in part on the status of Rohingya women.
Genocide forced the Rohingya to flee Myanmar in 2017. Chikufa Ra was pregnant when she and her 4-year-old daughter walked for days to reach the camps in neighboring Bangladesh. She's lived there now for 3 years with her husband and 2 daughters. We spoke by phone through an interpreter. Since the coronavirus threat appeared, she says, clinics and schools have closed. Many volunteers are gone. It's difficult to find food, and fear is rampant. The internet's been blocked, so many people don't have basic information about the disease. There have been lots of rumors and misinformation about how it spread. Nearly 900,000 people are packed into the camps across Bangladesh. Chikufa says many wouldn't survive a coronavirus outbreak because there's no way to isolate the sick. Women are the ones who provide the care in families, and they would be the main caregivers if people fell ill. But Chikufa says women are treated like they're unimportant and don't know anything.
I mean, and for that, we're particularly concerned because the Rohingya community as a whole is quite conservative and patriarchal.
Marie Sophie Pedersen is with United Nations Women.
Within the overall structures in the camps, women are often not in decision-making positions. There's no female camps in charge. There's only 10 women police in the whole camps. But then at the same time, we see that there can be very disproportionate impacts on women and girls.
Even before the coronavirus, she says, girls and women were trafficked and forced into marriage. Since the lockdown, levels of domestic violence have spiked. And now, because women are the caregivers, they'll likely be among the first infected.
This COVID-19 crisis could have devastating impacts if we don't prevent or mitigate the risks.
Humanitarian workers are frantically producing videos and podcasts about how the infection spreads. Louise Donovan is with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees in Bangladesh.
Not everybody is literate, and there isn't a written Rohingya language also, so it's quite challenging.
Donovan says they're working to expand medical and isolation facilities as much as possible and taking steps to improve hygiene.
So huge distributions of soap across the camps, establishing hand washing facilities at all distribution centers and every communal facility in the camp.
There's some capacity for coronavirus testing, she says, but more medical equipment and resources are needed.
Everybody is looking for additional capacities and resources at the moment. I think at this time, it's very clear that this is a global problem and no population can be excluded from that.
Among her community, Chikufa Ra, the refugee and mother, has taken matters into her own hands and become one of the few women leaders in the response to the crisis. Before the genocide, she says, her family was filled with social workers and government officials, and she learned how to organize from them. She's built a network of 400 refugee women who are going door to door to educate people about COVID-19 and recruit more women to help. They've put together makeshift health clinics and arranged transportation for people who might get sick. If an outbreak hits, these women will be prepared to respond, no matter what the men say. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Like many museums around the world, the Museum of Modern Art in New York is closed because of the coronavirus. You can still enjoy parts of the collection online, though, like a new audio project from artist Chemi Rosada Seijo called Beyond the Uniform. It's a collection of stories about how art moves, informs, and inspires us. Told by people who usually don't get to do the talking at museums, the museum security guards. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has our story.
When the Museum of Modern Art isn't closed, Kevin Reed spends 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, standing in the galleries keeping watch over the art. He says from time to time, people acknowledge him, but not really.
Most people just come in here, they just ask us a question and it's go.
Like, where's the bathroom? How do I get to the cafeteria?
At least address me first before you just say, like, hey, where's this? Like, hey, how are you? How you doing?
The artist Chemi Rosado Seijo knows guards have much more to tell you than where the bathroom is. He put together a new audio guide for the museum called Beyond the Uniform, which you can listen to online even though the museum is closed.
Hi there. Hola, buen día. ¿Qué tal? My name is Chemi Rosado Seijo. I am an artist from Puerto Rico.
In the guide, 9 guards, including Kevin, choose a piece of art from the MoMA's collection and talk about it. Altogether, there are 20 audio essays. Little jewels, really. This is the first one where Chemi explains his inspiration for the guide. And that's Kevin singing in the background. Because, by the way, Kevin's a musician.
One thing that I've been noticing through the past probably 20-something years is that most security guards, they are black. Or they are brown people, as they call us, yeah. Puerto Ricans or Colombians or Dominicans.
Mr. Invisible, doesn't make sense to you? People look through you, but don't see what's in you. I'm standing right in front of you. You ain't looking hard enough, yes.
I thought that's the community I want to work with. A lot of these guards are artists themselves, and that's a big reason why they work here. They want to be surrounded by these pieces of art, and they want to protect it too. And actually, they want to tell you more than it's on the walls.
For Kevin's contribution to the guide, he chose to talk about a painting by the African-American artist Kerry James Marshall called Untitled Policeman. It's a monumental portrait of a black policeman perched on the hood of his cruiser, painted in 2015.
It's a very, very provocative piece, and it's just telling of the world that I'm living in right now. It connects so much. Black Lives Matter, the senseless police shootings, injustice, prejudice.
Black men are pretty much invisible in the history of Western painting, both as artists and as subjects. And when they do appear in paintings, they're usually supporting characters or some exoticized fantasy. But not in this portrait. Here, the policeman is front and center, and he's looking off to the side. You have no idea what he's thinking.
He's in this uniform. He's doing his job, but they don't see that this man probably is just working to feed his family. Once he takes off the uniform, he could be somebody different. It could be that he's conflicted with doing his job. This man is probably just sitting down. It's like, they only knew who I really was.
Kevin finds meaning in a portrait. Rabila Kanak, another security guard, finds meaning in a landscape. A pretty famous one.
When I started working here, every visitor asks, where is the Starry Night? Where is the Starry Night? And then I realized, I really want to know what is this piece is.
In Vincent van Gogh's Starry Night, painted in 1889, the sky is alive with swirling, roiling patterns. The stars, moon, and planets glow in circles of yellow and white light. Underneath the turbulence lies a sleepy village. Starry Night was painted in the French countryside, but it looks familiar to Rabila.
I'm originally from Bangladesh. My village is similar to this painting. The night is more richly, more alive than the day. And these paintings, I believe, he created like early morning before sun rising. So sometimes when I have to decide something, I wake up that time, I look outside from the window, and I have some thought like that.
The artist Chemi Rosado Seijo says he hopes these audio guides give other people permission to connect to art in a personal way.
I do expect that people are like, oh, so the guards are talking about their artworks. I can talk about the artworks.
Chemi says that all too often he'll be talking to somebody about art and then all of a sudden they'll censor themselves.
Saying, I don't know about art, I should not be talking about it. Or, I don't really know about it, but I like it or I dislike it. And for me, that's the important part, is that why you like it, why you don't like it, from your own very own perspective. And it's valid.
And now when everyone is stuck at home, it's actually a great time to go online, connect with some art, listen to Kevin and Rabila and the other guards talk about it, and see how it speaks to you. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Beyond the Uniform is at MoMA.org. At our website, you can check out Untitled Policeman, Starry Night, and other images mentioned in the audio guide. We're at TheWorld.org. In the Catholic Church, confessions have to be done in person, can't be on the phone or Zoom. So what to do in the time of a pandemic? Some Canadian priests came up with a solution.
We thought drive-through would be a great way. People would remain in their cars.
Reverend James Hughes is at St. Patrick's Roman Catholic Parish in Vancouver, British Columbia. St. Patrick's is in the heart of Vancouver. They have an underground parking lot, so they move confession down there. Reverend Hughes and two other priests set up some chairs. They put out some orange cones and traffic instructions. And if you don't have a car, the priest also set up a walk-through station with a protective screen. Reverend Hughes says business is booming.
I'd say out of almost 6 hours of hearing confessions, there was maybe a 10-minute break from no penitence. So it was just steady.
Reverend Hughes says it's been a joy to reconnect with people and added, during the pandemic, the chance to talk, to confess, might be more important than ever.
We often experience people wanting to return to the sacrament just because, you know, the pandemic is one that gets this media attention now. But let's face it, there's all kinds of issues of suffering. And COVID-19 is only one of a plentitude of situations.
And with that plenitude of situations will come more confessions. To set the mood in the underground confessional,
I had a joy for having beautiful, peaceful Gregorian chants played in the background.
Gregorian chants sets a mood and keeps other parishioners from eavesdropping on those most intimate of sins. That was Reverend James Hughes of St. Patrick's Roman Catholic Parish in Vancouver speaking to the CBC program As It Happens. And here's my confession. We're at the end of the hour. What, you were expecting something juicier? Sorry to disappoint. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.